Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome. Okay, probably mentioned we're both a little tired. We just finished a retreat yesterday for the Zen Yoga group and went really well. And as Kate has probably already mentioned, we're going to share this talk. And hopefully it's not going to be one of those talks where you're invited to, you know, look at someone's slides of the Grand Canyon and their summer trip. But we did want to, you know, share something about the trip that's meaningful for us. This is our third time leading groups to Japan. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about travel, you know, this, that we, why we travel. And certainly in the Buddhist tradition, travel and pilgrimage, another kind of travel, has played such a key role from the very beginning. The Buddha and the early monks and nuns lived as mendicants, wandering from place to place, stopping only during the rainy season to kind of come together. And then in the early Chinese tradition, the Chinese monks also traveled. Some of the famous ones traveled from China to India to study, collect the more sutras, and bring those back to China. And then in China, as the Zen tradition developed a little bit later, there also arose the custom of wandering from temple to temple. So you would practice for a while under one teacher in a particular temple, and then at some point you would leave, and you would kind of test, I guess is often how it's translated, you would test your knowledge, your ability, your insight with other teachers around. And certainly in Japan, we have the famous example of Basho, who was also ordained, but the famous poet who traveled all around Japan several times. And Ryokan, another famous poet who was a Soto Zen monk who wandered. And then who also wrote about their travels afterwards, both Basho and Ryokan. And there are many others. This seems to be a theme within this particular tradition, within the Buddhist tradition and within the Zen tradition, of traveling from place to place. And certainly travel is not tourism. I make a strong distinction between the two. I think travel is when we deliberately place ourselves in the unfamiliar. We deliberately place ourselves, perhaps even in the uncomfortable. And in this way, we come to see the world is not as we thought it was, not as we think it is. We see the world differently. In travel, we leave the familiar. And as Sue Moon wrote in a recent Tricycle article, we may come to see how miraculous everything is when we travel. I'm sure you've all had similar experiences. Suddenly everything becomes miraculous with that cloth bag over your shoulder as you're wandering down this unfamiliar road. I think one of the reasons our ancestors went on pilgrimage, on these kind of sacred trips, was to kind of shake off that illusion or that delusion that we have when we fall into everyday routine, that this is my life. Right. Every morning I get up at 6:30, brush my teeth, take a shower, get ready for work, go to work, and that becomes life. And they shake off the routine that, you know, our life should be smooth. You know, we don't want upsets. We don't want our car to suddenly not work. Somehow we have this delusion that life should be like the prairie, you know. It goes on forever, right? As far as you can see, that'll be my life, right? I can see right almost to the end. Be safe, secure, perhaps. But travel teaches us impermanence. That we don't know what our life will present us from one moment to the next. That was my first lesson when I arrived in Japan. My shiny, relatively new 10-year passport lasted 2.5 days in Japan. Before it was whisked away, never to return. And keeping my passport company was my Visa card and a bunch of cash. Now, I'd like to report that I was completely equanimous. But as Kate could testify, that was not the truth. At least certainly for the first day or so. And yet, you know, as my... This is before everyone had started to arrive in Japan, the group of... 18 people that we were going to lead around. As my kind of fellow travelers arrived, something quite interesting happened. Aside from the early morning bouts of wondering if I would ever leave Japan, if I would ever get a passport from the embassy in Tokyo, because they were rather reticent to communicate with me. You know, they would say, "You're missing this, you're missing that. Do this, do that," but they never said, "It's coming," or anything like that, so. But aside from those early morning anxiety attacks, I guess, I really entered fully into the trip with other people. It just dropped away. And it felt like, okay, losing a passport is, and I'm not sure who coined this term, but it's bourgeois suffering. That's all it is.
It is a Tibetan teacher.
Pema Chodron.
No.
When it was her
teacher.
Oh, her teacher. Oh, okay, yeah. A lovely expression. Because that's all it is. And that became quite clear to me, especially later on. That's like another thing I'll talk about. So this sudden plunge into not knowing, right? Not knowing when my passport would come, this sudden plunge into, you know, the kind of things of that we hang on to as security suddenly yanked out, was actually quite a gift, because that gives us a freedom. You know, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen next. Well, I've already lost my passport, Visa card, a bunch of cash. What's next? So, in many ways, that for me set the tone, both positive and a kind of negative tone as well, for the trip. But it also cracked me open in some way. One of the ways I think that it really opened me up was to be open to the generosity that was constantly there in Japan. And I'm sure everyone on the trip will have stories to say of moments of generosity, unexpected moments of generosity that had happened. But I'd like to just mention two. One was the generosity that we experienced when we stayed at Rinzo in the Suzuki Roshi's temple in a place called Shizuoka. This is... the temple of our lineage, going back to Suzuki Roshi, who brought this form of Zen to North America, This was his temple in Japan. And there, at Rinso-in, there was Hojo-sama, or Hojo-san, who is the current abbot and the son of Suzuki Roshi, and he's now 77.
Almost.
Yeah, 77 years old. And the temple itself is 500?
600.
600 years old. So it's an old, venerable temple. And I remember Norman saying when we were there with Norman Fisher, the person who ordained us, and Norman said, you know, if I could study again with somebody, it would be with Hojo-san. He would be the person I would practice with. And I can really understand that so clearly. He was very welcoming. But there are two things that touched me very deeply. One was, he gave a Dharma, formal Dharma talk, and he gave some informal Dharma talks as well, and we were there, and Kate and I were translating. And at one point he said, in Japanese, you are the same kafu. And Kate and I were kind of like, what's kafu? We were wondering, like, oh, what's this? Well, you know, and then he realized we were kind of like struggling with that, and he said, there's two characters for it. It's house wind. House wind. And it means the same wind. How can I put this?
Family. The house also means family.
Family, yeah.
Family.
The wind of the family. Like we share the same wind. We're the same lineage. But not lineage in that formal way of lineage, you know. There's something more intimate than that. A wind that passes through from generation to generation. And I found that very moving, you know, that we, you know, are kind of...
Our scruffy band.
Yeah, kind of a little bit bumbling, unsure, kind of awkward foreigners coming in, and he sees this intimacy there and expresses it in a very beautiful way. And the second thing he did was, I remember it was at the end of a morning service. I had turned, I was going to do something, and he comes, I heard this thump, 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 thump up behind me, and he says, tomorrow you and Kate do morning service. You and Kate will do the service. So, and he says, Kate will do the bells here, and he gives me this stick, which is the kind of teaching staff, the one we carry it sometimes. He says, you in Yubidoshi. And that's what we did for the last two days that we were there. We were doing the morning service. He was sitting on the side. There were, you know, some parishioners from Rinso in there too, kind of wondering what the heck's going on. Half of it, you know, most of it's in English. But it was very warm and very moving for both of us to have that opportunity. And the second kind of little story of kind of generosity and kindness I wanted to just quickly mention was a nun that we met at a small temple in the northeast of Kyoto called Jakkoin. And we had just a place we'd gone there to visit with a group of people on one of the free days. And Jakkoin is a relatively historically famous temple. You know, a number of tourists go there, but it's relatively small. A little bit off the beaten track. But we were there, kind of looking around, and as I was walking, we had just kind of left the main kind of temple part, walking to another little building. This elderly nun, in her late 60s?
70.
Yeah,
she's right around 70.
Sees me, and she calls out to me in Japanese, which is a little bit unusual because I don't look Japanese. And she says, where are you from? And thus begins a conversation that we have about, I explain a little bit about who we are and what we're doing there. And then she disappears. And she says, wait a minute, disappears and comes back with presents. She gives us a picture of Jizo, which I meant to bring when I forgot, which I'll bring next time. And then a pack of cloths with the logo of the temple stamped on them, the often little gifts that you can give away pretty easily. And we're standing there with other two kind of people around us, talking away. And she says, I want to tell you how hopeful I am that Obama has come to Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. That this she found deeply, deeply moving. Because much of her life, and she became a nun only after, I think in her 50s, mm-hmm. came out later.
After raising two sons.
Yeah. She was very concerned about world peace, had been deeply moved by, you know, stories that she had heard about Hiroshima and other places and the wars that were going on around the world. And over again, she talked about her deep concern and wish to end all war. And that it was our duty, our responsibility. And I think she meant as people who are ordained to work to make great effort for world peace. You just never know what's going to happen, who you will meet, who will touch you in some deep way. And then the last thing I want to talk about, because Kate's going to take over in a moment, was at the very beginning of the trip, I made a kind of intention or a kind of vow not to turn away or avoid difficult situations. It was a really interesting practice to do this for the trip because I'm working with, you know, a second language that I'm pretty rusty in, and there are times when you're working with 18 people, you just want a little peace and quiet and be by yourself. But that was my intention, and I tried to keep that as much as I could. And it led to many wonderful things. I highly recommend it as a practice to pick up. Simply not turn away. But the situation that I think it touched me most deeply was after people had left, Kate and I stayed on in Japan for a few days. And we went to a town, a small city where I had lived first. When I first went to Japan as a young man, I was 19, Kanazawa. I studied Aikido there for a couple of years. But over the years, I had lost contact with everybody there, everyone that I knew. And I had this kind of vague hope of maybe, you know, getting in contact, you know, meeting a few people again. And I wanted to visit the grave site of my Aikido teacher who had died. He died in 1999. And I must say at times I had felt, oh, maybe it's too much. You know, lost my passport, this money, and, you know, maybe we should just go somewhere else. But we went. And I asked at the information center if they knew of any Singaporean restaurant. Always a good idea to ask these kind of things when we got there, because I knew some of my old Aikido colleagues had started up a Singaporean restaurant. And I won't go into the reasons why, but it's connected with my teacher, who was actually Japanese but had been born in Malaysia. So this kind woman looked it up and she said, yeah, there is one. It's Don Don Te. And as soon as I heard that name, it sounded familiar.
Still there.
And so we made it there. And it was two people who were not people I had practiced with that I could remember at all, but they knew the names of people I had. And thus began this series of phone calls and, you know, finding out where, and they went to quite a bit of effort to get me this information to find out where some of the people I met, where they were living. And I made contact again with these dear people I had practiced with for a number of years. One of them being my teacher who I'd first practiced with here in Vancouver, who had, you know, gone back and was living in Japan, I had lost contact with. But there was one other person, a man named Hanayan, who had been very kind to me when I first arrived in Japan. And we had an interesting experience together. Shortly after I arrived, he had had his he had appendicitis and had his appendix removed. And his job was working for a laundry company, delivering sheets and towels to restaurants and picking up the dirty laundry, and then, you know, into saunas. You know, this kind of job. And he asked if I could help him as he was recovering. So we drove around in this white van for about a month, and I was hauling dirty laundry into the van and clean laundry out, and got to know him quite well, you know, during this time. And at the end, we would always end up at a sauna. And in Japan, these saunas are like, you know, several floors big. There's like, you know, three or four or five different pools and steam rooms, all kinds of things like that that you can enjoy. So we always end up at the sauna and, you know, get cleaned up and relax. But I found out he was in hospital. he had had a stroke 2 years earlier, which left his left side completely numb and with no movement at all. And he had been moved from a regular hospital to this other kind of hospital clinic where he was getting, you know, therapy every day. But for the last 2 years of his life, essentially he'd been hospitalized. And when I went there, he was in a shared room. There was no one else there but him. And in bed, just laying in the bed with other people out, up and about in wheelchairs, etc. But he can't manage a wheelchair by himself either. And I was very grateful to be able to spend some hour, about an hour, 45 minutes, an hour with him, talking a little bit. And to, in some small way, repay a little bit of his kindness to me. So small. And yet, I think for both of us, it was also a kind of a joyous occasion to see each other again. So I think that arose from that not turning away. Because at each step, you know, although I haven't talked about this in detail, there was moments, oh, it's too much. Oh, you know, he's in hospital, he probably doesn't remember me. I should, you know, should I bother him? Should I, you know, all of these things arose. But just not turning away led to something, for me, a very precious moment in Japan. So maybe I'll end there. Thank you.
Well, hello, everyone. I find this prospect a little bit daunting because I'm tired. And my relationship with Japan is so many faceted and layered and complex, and yet also very, very simple. And I only had a chance to scribble down a few notes. So I'll do my best to somehow put this into words. Japan for me, as I said, is my experience is always many layered. From the personal to the family to the societal and beyond. How I came to have a personal relationship with Japan is kind of a mystery to me. I can't even claim to be a Japanophile. Like, some people totally fall in love with Japan and everything Japanese. There are things I'm definitely not in love with about Japan. I think it's hard for, as a woman, to be a complete Japanophile. And yet there are things I love deeply about Japan. For me, maybe it started, I practiced Aikido as well in my 20s, as Michael did. And people, when I say that, people say, oh, well, you know, is that why you went to Japan? But it wasn't. It wasn't. It was the language. I started to learn the language because I wanted to travel, and I wanted to not just to travel, I wanted to live in an Asian country, and Japan seemed the best prospect, you know, because you can make a living there by teaching English. So I thought, okay, I love languages, so I'm going to go. I took first year intensive Japanese one summer at UBC, and I just loved it. I was just completely immersed, and then launched into a degree in Japanese, and then got a scholarship to go study there, and discovered Japanese poetry. So it was the language, it was the poetry, really, that hooked me initially. Something absolutely magical about being able to communicate in a language so different from English, in a language that has a high tolerance for ambiguity, that has a writing system that's incredibly complicated but incredibly beautiful. That the characters themselves are poetry. And then living there, it was the land. You know, it was the seasons, it was the birds and the plants, the vividness of the seasons, and the oldness, you know, the interpenetration of the culture and the land that makes our Western immigrant culture on this land seemed like such a thin surface. The folklore, the earthy folk culture and the highly refined culture that interpenetrate and influence each other. So much, Japan is such a land of contrasts, you know, the vivid contrasts of the seasons, steep mountains, fast running rivers. I came to see why Dogen wrote the Mountains and Waters Sutra out of his life in Japan, out of his direct experience of that landscape. The warmth of the people and the chill of the people, both. The culture can be full of such warmth and generosity, but also excluding, harshly excluding. So for reasons that are still kind of very mysterious and inexplicable to me, I developed this personal relationship with this culture and this country and people. And Zen practice as expressed through that culture. Seems to fit for me. And then the other layer is a family layer, because as many of you know, my sister came to visit Michael and me when we were living in Kyoto, kind of fell in love with a Japanese friend of ours, and went to Japan, moved to Japan a year after we returned, married him, and then a year after that came down with the most aggressive kind of lymphoma there is. And she died 7 months later in Japan. 5 of those months I spent with her, and it was a very intense and life-changing experience, and definitely another round of engagement with Japanese culture, being the intermediary between my family and her in-laws and her husband. So that was that's another big layer for me, which was more muted this time. You know, it was sort of quietly, gently there in the background. But there was a gap. My sister died in 1990, and Michael and I went in the year 2005 on the Jesus for Peace pilgrimage to Hiroshima and Nagasaki with two Zen teachers, Chozen and Hogen Bays, from Oregon, with a group of about 30 people. And that was a very profoundly layered and complex experience for me after a 15-year gap. I had thought maybe that was it. I'm done with Japan. I didn't know if I'd ever go back. And I did. And then now 3 more times. So there's some, I feel a kind of increasing, oddly strengthening kind of strength, connection and responsibility to maintain the connection. And that's the other level is this level of societies, of the country of Japan and the country of my birth, the United States, my complex kind of love-hate relationship with both those countries and cultures, and healing. You know, I see both those countries as in some way arrogant cultures, ignorant of the rest of the world and their effect on the rest of the world. At least in some ways and times in history. And so I feel that there are kind of karmic relationships between the two cultures that are still healing, you know, going on the pilgrimage to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Taught me that. And And this trip, one thing I learned or felt differently from before is, yes, we were the recipients of much generosity, and Michael gave you some examples, and there were many more. But what I felt more this time was the reciprocality, that people were receiving something from us as well, and that that the connections were important. There was a new director of the international programs at Aheji, which is the big main headquarters training monastery for Soto priests in Japan, and this the new director had just started his job 2 days before, and turned out that we knew him. We had stayed at his temple in Hiroshima, and he had spent many years in not only in the States, but in Italy and somewhere else in Europe.
France.
Yeah, in his capacity as a Zen priest. And clearly he felt the importance of kind of reinvigorating the international department at this monastery, and that his young monks not be insular, that they have a confidence and familiarity with dealing with Zen in the wider world, and that that is necessary to the survival of Zen in Japan. He didn't say that, but I feel that was the implication. Michael said, we did service to the days when we stayed at Rinsoin, and I think my mode in Japan is, we're the schlumpy foreigners who can't, who can't do things right, and we can't even dress right, and we can't do anything right, and kind of in a state of perpetual semi-embarrassment at my lack of utmost propriety, and I had to let go of that. I had to let go of that. And realize that that our presence, our interest, our practice was offering and giving something to the people we met, and that it was important. And someone told me that one of the local women at Rinsoin, who came and practiced in the morning. There were anywhere from, I think, 5 to 8 people who come and sit zazen in the morning and stay for the morning service. And that one of the women had said how moved she was to hear the service being done in English. We did it partly in English, partly in Japanese. And and it wouldn't have occurred to me that she would feel that way. So I had to let go of my my mode of being in Japan and take my place. Our teacher Norman talks about taking your place. Taking my place in practice and offering that there. And that's different from any time I've been before. People in Japan are trying to address issues of world peace and of environmental destruction and climate change, but they're a small minority, and it feels good to connect to those people when we do, to the extent that we're able, and in a sense of mutual support. We went to a gallery in Nara, where the gallery owner is also an amazing designer and interior designer. But not only that, he is working on creating a kind of practice cultural organic farming center on the outskirts of Nara. And he's very excited about that, and it felt wonderful to share that and talk about organic farming with him. And it feels like another connection to nurture. The reason we met him was that Marley had been there on another trip to Japan with Kaz Tanahashi, who's a wonderful calligrapher and artist and translator whose work this gallery shows. So Sangha. Sangha is the other level here for me in operational. And it's a very wide, unlimitedly wide Sangha that making that travel trip, travel in the sense that Michael spoke about, where we get jostled out of our ruts, making that traveling to Japan, I think opened up my sense of Sangha most widely in a way that I think I receive and give and receive and give and receive and give strengthens me to know that. And I'm really grateful for the people who without their interest and curiosity and willingness to come and join that trip, we wouldn't even have gone. So this time, I think Claire's the only one here. And Kay.
Okay.
Yeah, Claire and Kay. But others before on previous trips. I'm grateful for those who, for our wonderful, wonderful traveling companions on the trip. And maybe we can hear a little bit from them too. But I'll close now. And thank you. Thank you for your